welcome to a new episode in the New Books in Gender Studies podcast. My name is Kyle McMillan, one of the co-hosts of the channel, and today I am here with Nancy Weiss Malkiel, and we're going to be talking about her book, Keep the Damned Women Out, The Struggle for Co-Education. Professor, how are you doing today?
I'm doing fine, Kyle. Glad to be with you.
Yeah. So if you just wanted to start out maybe talking a little bit about your professional career, your sort of academic trajectory, and what ultimately led you to write this sort of extensive work on the struggle for co-education.
I'd be happy to do that. I joined the history department at Princeton in 1969, right out of graduate school, as an assistant professor, and I worked as a teacher in 20th century American history, broadly defined, and my scholarship for the next couple of decades was in African American history, civil rights, black politics, organizations for racial advancement. I spent 24 years as dean of the college at Princeton, starting in 1987 and ending in 2011. When I came back to the faculty, it seemed to me that continuing to work in a field, African American history, that I had really not worked in for many, many years was probably not the best idea. I had an invitation from the president of Princeton, Shirley Tillman, who asked if I would be interested in writing a history of co-education at Princeton, and that fit very well with the fact that I had essentially lived co-education at Princeton since I arrived at the same time as the first undergraduate women. I was very much interested because of my responsibilities as a faculty member and a dean in the education of women as well as men at Princeton. And I'm an alumna of Smith College and spent a decade as a trustee there, so women's education has been very much on my mind for a long time. So I started out to write a history of co-education at Princeton, and what I soon came to realize was that there was a more interesting question, because there was such a flood of decisions for co-education at elite private colleges and universities in the United States and the United Kingdom in a very short space of time, starting in 1969. And so that's how I got to wondering why that flood had happened, how it worked, and with what results.
Yeah, so when you were focusing on those particular schools, who ended up being sort of the, you know, change agents or sort of the main actors in this push for co-education?
Well, Princeton and Yale are the prime movers. They get started and everyone else is watching them and not surprisingly following their lead. In the United Kingdom, it's another story. Cambridge and Oxford men's colleges begin admitting women in 1972 at Cambridge and in 1974 at Oxford, and they're doing that for reasons local to the United Kingdom and not directly because of what was going on in the United States, even though what was happening at Princeton and Yale had an influence there as well.
Yeah, so a large part of sort of your chapters on the, you know, context of the U.S. and the U.K. is sort of the broader social context surrounding the schools. So what was sort of happening around this time that sort of influenced this sort of call to co-education or struggle to get there for some of the schools?
Well, let me answer that in two ways. The first is that the context of the 1960s was critically important. The civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, the student movement, the women's movement. By the end of the 1960s, colleges and universities looked quite different than they had at the beginning of the decade. This is the period also when a number of these very elite, very traditional private institutions begin to diversify their student bodies to admit more public school students, students from less advantaged backgrounds, Catholic and Jewish students, even some African Americans. So this overall social context sets a framework within which co-education becomes something that is no longer so unimaginable, but rather seems to be almost necessary. The trigger in this general context for Princeton and Yale, and then for Dartmouth and for Vassar, for a number of the institutions that go co-ed, the trigger was admissions. And the fact that by the late 1960s, if you look at Princeton and Yale, who were, as I said, the prime movers here, their applications are beginning to fall off and their yields. In other words, the decisions that admitted students make are beginning to change. And what they see is that high school students, male high school students, they liked to refer to as the best boys, were changing their views on where they wanted to go to school. They wanted to go to school with girls. And this is when Harvard begins to pull away from Princeton and Yale in admissions. So losing some of their hold on the best boys was, in the view of people at Princeton and Yale, really unsustainable. And they looked to admit women, not because they had some moral conviction about educating women, not because of some high-minded commitment to the education of women. They admitted women because it was a way that they believed to help them recover their hold on these best boys. So they looked to co-education, where women would play an instrumental role in improving the education of men.
Yeah, so that kind of leads into my next question. It seems like in the U.S. context, there's sort of this dynamic between what you were talking about in terms of the academic competition and sort of the admissions battles that these schools were engaging in, but also the attitudes of some of the alumni. So I don't know if you wanted to speak to sort of what does that push and pull look like at each of these schools?
Alumni are highly problematic in this drama, if you will. They were fiercely opposed in the main, not entirely, but they thought that the way things were, the way things had been when they attended these schools, was the way they should continue to be. Let me give you some examples of this opposition. Take the title of my book. It comes from a letter from a Dartmouth alumnus to the chair of the Dartmouth board in 1970. He wrote, "For God's sake, for Dartmouth's sake, and for everyone's sake, keep the damned women out." When the Yale Corporation first began talking about the possibility of educating undergraduate women at Yale, one alumnus responded this way. He wrote, "There is a glory to tradition. I think of the girl-filled weekend, the cocktail party, the dances, the plays, the big football game. Then there is the adventure of journeying to the girls' colleges. And gentlemen," he said, "let's face it, charming as women are, they get to be a drag if you're forced to associate with them each and every day. Think of the poor student who has a steady date. He wants to concentrate on the basic principles of thermodynamics, but she keeps trying to gossip about the idiotic trivia all women try to impose on men. You get countless examples of alumni of these institutions saying, simply impossible, you will change our treasured alma mater irreparably and for the worse if you admit women.
Right, and what struck me, at least at some of the universities that you look at, was, you know, most of them would do sort of a study to see whether or not co-education would be, you know, usually they would frame it as feasible, right? So, you know, at these different institutions, you know, what were they aiming to, you know, really sort of grasp with these studies?
Look, if these institutions had found a way to bring women in close proximity without actually going co-ed, they would have leapt at the chance. That's the first thing to make clear. Every place that there's serious consideration of co-education tried very, very hard to do it short of co-education. In other words, look at Yale. Yale starts by seeing if they can persuade Vassar to move to New Haven in some coordinate relationship with Yale. And when Vassar tells Yale that it will stay in Poughkeepsie, thank you very much, Yale's next move is to think about how Yale can establish its own coordinate college for women. Princeton, seeing Yale talking to Vassar, began talking to Sarah Lawrence College about the possibility of Sarah Lawrence moving to Princeton across the lake from the university, close enough to solve the problems created by the absence of women students, but not so close as to fundamentally change the university. Dartmouth explored the possibility of getting Wheaton College or Skidmore College to move to Hanover. Any of these presidents would have jumped at the chance to establish a coordinate college for women if they could have pulled that off, because that would have solved all the problems of wouldn't have changed the fundamental male camaraderie, wouldn't have changed the special relationships and environment of an all-male institution that had for hundreds of years produced alumni who went on to leadership positions where these male friendships were so important to them, the male bonding. But they couldn't make that happen.
So what were the attitudes of the male students that were already at these institutions once co-education became sort of this hot-button issue?
Well, they were very complicated. On the one hand, there was a lot of student support for co-education. On the other hand, when the women actually arrived, they were less sure. The male students were less sure. And remember that these were male students who had applied to their institution and matriculated at their institution when it was all male. So it was one thing to say in the abstract, gee, it'd be nice to have women here. It was another to actually bring them and change the place. There are lots of examples of male students responding in ways that suggested that maybe it wasn't so comfortable and easy for them. For example, actually sitting down in a lecture hall next to a woman student. A lot of men thought they just couldn't do that. So there would be circles of empty seats around the one or two women in the classroom because men just couldn't quite handle it. There were explicit statements to women saying, essentially, you don't belong here. And the benign version went something like this. It's a girl. It talks. you know, when women would speak up in the classroom, there were titters around the room. There was amazement that a woman could actually sit there and participate in an intellectual conversation. There were more explicit forms of bad behavior. Dartmouth men, for example, hung banners from their dormitory windows declaring no co-eds or co-eds go home. Dartmouth men, when women entered the dining hall at Dartmouth, Dartmouth men shouted out numbers meant as ratings of attractiveness, as if they were rating the quality of a dive. Dartmouth men through the fraternities engaged in degrading, dangerous behaviors and scurrilous verbal assaults on women students. They marauded through women's dormitories. They really behaved abominably. And it wasn't just Dartmouth. You get behaviors at Yale, at Princeton, at other places where you just think, come on, kids, you really need to grow up. This isn't the way you're supposed to behave in college. I think it was, you know, a lot of these students had gone to all-male schools. A lot of them just didn't know how to handle themselves around women. And the curious part was that the social interaction was supposed to be the big draw of having women there. But it was very awkward for men at Princeton or at Yale to date their new female classmates. And they fell back on their time-honored practices of importing dates from women's colleges. So you'd be a friend during the week, but on the weekend, the woman student, would be supplanted by an imported date. I remember at Princeton, in the first years of coeducation, male students would say, well, I'm sure given the ratio that women, each woman student already has plenty of people lined up to date her, and so I'm not going to risk asking somebody out because I'll get shot down. And so what happened was that the women students sat home Saturday nights without dates because the men wouldn't ask them out because they were sure that they would get shot down in favor of other offers.
Yeah, and part of the sort of reasoning behind, like you said earlier, these institutions wanting to open up are sort of, you know, how can we sort of increase our admissions? And part of that has to do with the attitudes of women that were in high schools at this time. So what did that have to do with the push toward coeducation?
Well, men and women students were accustomed to associating with each other in high school in the context of the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement. They were accustomed to participating in protests together. They were accustomed, some of them, to participating in civil rights activism, registering black voters, for instance, picketing segregated establishments. So there was a lot of commonality in what these students shared in the context of the politics of the 1960s. So the notion that you would not go to school together in college when you were doing all these other things together seemed really anachronistic.
Right. And another sort of anachronistic point of view is some of the men that were in these positions of power at these institutions sort of thought of, you know, an all-male institution being sort of this thing that is quickly becoming a thing of the past. And one of the things that you point out in your book is the interesting position that line of thinking puts the traditionally all women's colleges in. So I don't know if you want to speak a little bit about that.
And it was tough for women's colleges to figure out how to navigate in this changing environment. The first thing that happened was that when Princeton, Yale, for example, went co-ed and admitted transfer students, large numbers of students from Smith and Wellesley, for example, were offered transfer admission. And, you know, the position of the men's colleges, Kingman Brewster, the president of Yale, would say to colleagues at Smith and Wellesley, look, I can't help it if large numbers of your students want to leave and come to New Haven, and it would be unfair if we didn't offer admission to the most talented among them, and then let them decide what they're going to do. So there was an inherent tension in terms of what the first moves to coeducation were going to do to the enrolled student bodies at these schools. But then the question was essentially, how are we going to compete in a world in which so many of the most elite, most attractive men's colleges are admitting women? They're admitting the women we, the women's colleges, would normally have attracted. And what is going to be our fate going forward? This is a big problem and challenge for the women's colleges. And they were really caught because, on the one hand, they thought that they were going to lose a significant part of their traditional constituency of the brightest female high school students. On the other hand, if they were to contemplate going co-ed themselves, they feared that they would be unable to attract a large number of men of sufficient quality to match the women who were enrolled. So it was really a conundrum. And they didn't want to go co-ed. Smith and Wellesley certainly didn't. They thought they had to seriously explore what would happen if they went co-ed. But this was a really tough problem for them. Vassar decided to admit men. Vassar's circumstances were different from Smith and Wellesley's. They had had the about 10-month-long serious exploration of the possibility of teaming up with Yale in New Haven. They were located geographically far from men's schools, far from cities. They were in a much tougher spot than Smith or Wellesley in terms of the possibility of a reasonable social life in proximity to their campuses. And their admissions were dropping off much faster than the admissions at Yale or Princeton. And Vassar had normally gone pretty much head-to-head with Smith and Wellesley in admissions, and that started to change significantly by the late 1960s. So Vassar thought that they really needed to act, whereas Smith and Wellesley could afford not to.
Yeah, and it was really interesting, sort of the role that the new wave of feminism had at these women colleges.
It was fascinating, in fact, because the student, Smith is a wonderful example. Student sentiment at Smith was overwhelmingly in favor of coeducation at two different points. In the late 1960s, Smith students were polled, and about two-thirds of them said, essentially, bring men to Northampton. So there's one more poll taken of Smith students in the fall of 70, and they flip, so that now two-thirds say, don't bring men to Northampton. We want to remain single sex. And the primary reasons for their change of mind had, first of all, to do with the experience of Smith students who had gone as transfer students to Yale and Princeton, or who had gone on exchange programs to places like Dartmouth, that, exchanges that were starting up, the 12 College Exchange, it was called. Well, what these students discovered was that it wasn't really quite so easy and comfortable to be at Yale or at Princeton, and that they really missed what they had back in Northampton. So that was one of the influences on changing opinion. The other was the women's movement, and that was particularly salient at Smith because Betty Friedan and Gloria Steinem were both Smith alums. Both of them, the public face of the women's movement of the 1960s and 1970s, and Gloria Steinem in particular was becoming very prominent in 1970. And the senior class at Smith invited her to speak at commencement at Smith in 1971. And she gave very hard-hitting commencement address about the importance of Smith as a feminist institution, the importance of remaining a college for women. So the feminism has a big effect on changing views, especially at Smith.
Yeah, and toward the sort of shifting gears here, toward the second half of the book, you sort of talk about what's happening in the United Kingdom. And so I wondered if you just want to first speak to, you know, if for those listening that may not know, sort of the structure of UK institutions that differ from how we understand institutions of higher education, and then sort of what is happening at these schools that made you sort of include them in your book.
Well, I focused especially on Oxford and Cambridge, and Oxford and Cambridge are organized with a lot of colleges within the university structure, and those colleges have a lot of autonomy. Those colleges, in the Cambridge case, included three colleges expressly for women, and then the largest majority of the colleges were for men. In the Oxford case, five colleges expressly for women, and the large majority of the colleges for men. These women's colleges had been founded in the late 19th century, but Oxford and Cambridge had been very slow, really, to embrace them and to allow women actually to earn degrees from the university. It took decades after the colleges were founded. What happened in the 1960s in the UK is that there was a general national recognition of the importance of opening additional places for students in British universities, and the importance especially of more places for women. And Cambridge and Oxford were, in effect, the worst offenders. The percentage of women nationwide in the 1960s in British universities was about 28%. In Cambridge and Oxford, many, many fewer women than that. So there was a sense that Cambridge and Oxford needed to do their part to open more places for women, but the women's colleges themselves couldn't do it. They didn't have the resources, the wherewithal, to educate more women. So if there were going to be more women at Cambridge and Oxford, it would have to come through men's colleges going co-ed. It was also the case that the movements of the 1960s that were influential in the United States were felt in the UK as well. Not the civil rights movement, of course, but the student movement, the anti-war movement, then the women's movement. So the notion that change would be appropriate was a current that was quite common to the UK as well as the United States. Another thing that happened in the UK is that in a number of these colleges, well, the way these colleges worked, the faculty, they're called fellows or dons, the faculty are in charge. They are the decision makers in the colleges. And what happened in these colleges is that new cohorts of fellows were appointed in the 1960s who were much younger and more progressive than the older fellows who had never been anywhere but Oxford or Cambridge. And for these young people, it seemed really out of place to continue to have single-sex institutions. So those were some of the factors that influenced what was going on. The other, there is a form of the strategic advantage that I spoke about in the United States that came from admitting women to regain one's hold on the best male high school students. In the UK, it went this way. The colleges at Cambridge and Oxford, respectively, are ranked in tables called the Norrington Table and the Tompkins Table, and those are essentially rankings of the colleges in each university in terms of the academic achievements of their students. And the way it worked, the women's colleges were at the top of these tables, both at Oxford and at Cambridge. So the men's colleges that decided to go co-ed first tended to be middling colleges, not the strongest colleges, and they thought that by admitting women, they could do two things. One, they could draw some of that talent from the women's colleges and improve their own academic standing. And they also thought that male students who might otherwise have thought, well, we'll apply to the strongest colleges at Oxford and Cambridge, that if the middling colleges went co-ed, some of those stronger male students might want to come there, and that would improve the fortunes of these colleges that were in the vanguard of going co-ed.
Yeah, and it was interesting to see the different roles that alumni played in the UK versus the United States. And part of that has to do, I'm sure, with the sort of just financial structure between the two countries, correct?
Oh, absolutely. You know, in the United States, alumni are critical to the financial well-being and the financial strength of these institutions. Alumni giving, annual giving, and capital gifts of consequence have been just essential to the ability of these institutions to grow and flourish. That was not the case in the UK. The structure of funding for these institutions just didn't depend on soliciting money from alumni, and that meant that the graduates were less consequential, less of a possibly obstructionist factor than was true in the United States. Alumni of Oxford and Cambridge colleges also came to understand what alumni of American institutions came to understand, which was that as much as they might want to preserve things the way they had been in the all-male world they had known, going co-ed actually opened opportunities for their daughters and granddaughters. And so something that looked unthinkable in the abstract became very attractive, in fact, to graduates who had daughters and granddaughters who would like to follow the fathers and grandfathers to colleges they had attended.
Yeah, so I think that an appropriate sort of expansive last question is how you sort of end the book. So you kind of lay it out with what did coeducation do and what did it not do? And I think that's a really important point that you make. So if you wanted to get into that.
Yeah, it's complicated to appraise the results of these changes. On the one hand, and undeniably, first-class educational opportunities are opened to women students at the highest level. And so you have access to world-class faculty, to facilities, to laboratories, to libraries that are unparalleled in the world, and where women have every access that men do. And that's critically important, it seems to me. Coeducation meant that women students had every opportunity that men did to excel academically, to prepare themselves for professional careers, for positions of leadership, in the same fashion that men do. And if you look at the women who have been the most consequential leaders in various fields, you know, up until coeducation, there are women who went to women's colleges. But after these institutions admit women, the most consequential women leaders have come out of co-ed institutions. No surprise, I think. On the other hand, co-education has not solved perplexingly gendered conundrums, problems, challenges. To give just a few examples, it continues to be the case at the best American institutions, at Oxford, at Cambridge, that at the very highest levels academically, men are outperforming women. It continues to be the case that there are gendered patterns of selection of subjects of study, so that in math, in physics, in computer science, in economics, you have significantly fewer women pursuing academic work than you do men. It continues to be the case that university faculties are not anywhere near evenly balanced in terms of gender, even though student bodies are. And as we know, it continues to be the case that there are significantly fewer women than men in positions of leadership in major law firms, in major corporations. Women are underrepresented on boards of Fortune 500 companies. There are just many fields in which it is just really tough to achieve some sort of gender parity, and leave aside the question how much gender had to do with the American presidential election. There are all sorts of gendered challenges that coeducation didn't touch, and I would argue couldn't have been expected to touch. Sexual harassment on campuses. is one example. A second example is the difficulty of conducting a high-level professional career for a woman at the same time that she's raising children, and how the workplace does and does not accommodate those conflicting imperatives. So there are a lot of gendered problems that continue inside and beyond the academy. That coeducation, as I said, coeducation didn't address, and I think in the main, probably we wouldn't be fair in saying coeducation should have solved these problems.
Right, and I think, you know, that's a good spot to leave this discussion. But Professor, I really enjoyed your book, and I'm sure that people that listen to this podcast will really enjoy it. So thank you for joining us in the New Books Network.
Thank you very much, Kyle. Pleasure to be with you.